This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the G8 summit concludes and a Biggie Smalls mistrial. From our New York bureau, John McWhorter. He's with the Manhattan Institute. He's a senior fellow there in public policy. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington is joining us from our bureau in Chicago. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, joins us from Washington today. All right, folks, obviously the world's attention on London yesterday, and to some degree this took the light away from the G8 summit and what we are finding. George Curry, talk to me a little bit about what you have been able to discern and what your thoughts are of what we've heard so far from this summit.
Yeah, I think the G8 leaders had a problem in the sense that they want to go on and not be defeated by terrorists and say we're going to take care of business, even though Tony Blair had to go back home. But at the same time, you see this omnipotent presence of terrorism. And so with all the very, very constructive talk about money and debt, wiping out the debt to certain countries in Africa, it got overshadowed in all this. And it's just a shock of it all came home again.
John, one of the things that had been hoped by many is that these men would in fact forgive the debt to the continent of Africa versus 18 of the poorest countries, many of whom find themselves on that continent. Do you believe that this continues to be problematic, that there is not the entire wiping out of the debt for the continent for it to begin to resurrect itself to some degree?
Oh, well, if you look at all of the arguments pro and con, it seems clear to me that one of the first things we have to do is eliminate as much of that debt as possible. But unfortunately, there are some incredible barriers, and I know we're not supposed to say this, but they're cultural barriers, not inherent to the people, but in terms of various things that have snowballed over the years. And it seems that after we forgive the debt, if we don't do something about the possibility of Charles Taylor coming back into power, for example, Liberia, or in the Congo, the fact that Joseph Kabila would lose an argument with a cloud in a country that's having a terrible war, and the idea that Robert Mugabe is often treated as some sort of legitimate force, then we're just going to see the same sorts of problems. We've got to work with those three leaders in particular, as well as against corruption, malaria, and AIDS, it seems, in roughly that order. But definitely debt forgiveness seems to be the only humane or practical thing to do.
So, Laura, the idea of having to conform to certain criteria, if you will, by virtue of what the G8 leaders put forth, some African countries will continue to see this as too paternal.
Of course.
Do they have to put their ego away, though, to survive, I guess, is the big question.
That's a tough thing to ask them to do, given the long history of paternalism as it relates to that continent. I always want to pick up on John's point about, you know, cultural barriers. And I think the cultural barriers are as much with us in Western countries as they are in Africa, with attitudes about, yes, some questions about some despotic or presumed to be despotic leaders, but also just attitudes about Africa and lack of understanding and lack of information and knowledge about Africa, and just seeing this as just a continent awash in corruption. We have to be able to try to change that conversation. I think the other issue, of course, we haven't talked about yet is the whole issue of climate change. And I think one of the important things that came out earlier in the week before we had this debacle in London was George Bush's admission or acknowledgement that that maybe some climate change is created by human beings. And that was a pretty significant step for him. But unfortunately, all that got wiped off the table with the attacks in London. And I think it's interesting because I think while there was much sincerity in terms of what leaders wanted to accomplish in terms of these issues coming from the Tony Blairs and the George Bushes, I think this was also an attempt to try to knock the Iraq issue, the terrorism issue, off the table and get back to business. And we've got control of that situation. There's other things in the world going on. And I think what Tony Blair in particular found out yesterday is it always comes back to Iraq and his close relationship with the United States and the discomfort that many Britons have with that.
George, did you see the events of yesterday as, to some degree, the chickens coming home to roost, the idea of what Laura just suggested there, and these groups saying, no, we're not going to let you knock this off the table. This is still front and center. You're going to have to deal with it.
Oh, I don't know if I'd put it in those terms, Ed. I guess I keep going back to when we should have addressed this much earlier with the embassies in Africa at the time. I know some people who were personally involved in that. It's just a threat that we did not take seriously enough, early enough, and that's what we're paying for.
It was very obvious. I mean, in you know, after the fact, that something like the G8 summit would get hit. Terrorists like to hit high-profile locations at high-profile times, and so they can send a number of different messages by hitting England, by hitting this summit. And it's amazing to me that there wasn't more attention paid to security. There was more attention paid to the protesters and security in terms of keeping them in line than there was in terms of worrying about terrorism.
I don't know how you can protect yourself against this. I really don't. I mean, you look at all those cameras. I thought we had a lot in D.C. Boy, they really have them in London, everywhere.
And you look at
all that, and you just simply say, this kind of attack, you really can't protect yourself.
This is what I mean when I often say, in terms of our war on terror, we have to realize what incredible danger we're in all the time, so that when these things happen, our first impulse is not to look back at things that people may have done wrong 6 or 7 years ago and point our fingers, but to think about what we can do about it right now and what sacrifices that might entail.
It is, unfortunately, the world we live in today. All right, let me, with the two reporters on the panel, this is very interesting. We've been following this story for some time, and that we saw some movement this week, not unexpected. A U.S. judge ordered New York Times reporter Judith Miller to jail on Wednesday for refusing to divulge her source in the investigation of a leak of an undercover CIA officer's name. That was published in a story that she did. Interesting here, though, we had heard so much about two reporters. A Time magazine reporter, Matthew Cooper, said that he will now cooperate with a federal prosecutor's investigation into the leak of the identity of this person because his source gave him specific authority to discuss their conversation. He also suggested that he changed his mind the morning or the night before he was to stand before the judge, as he held and hugged his son goodbye and told him that it might be a long time before he saw his young son again. George Curry, I'm interested to know, having been a reporter for so very long, what your thought is here.
First of all, Judy Miller never published a story with the source in it, and the person who did, Robert Novak, is not being prosecuted. I mean, that's the irony of all of this. It's in a democracy, you know, a lot of people talk about the press and they rank us down there with the used car dealers, but in a democracy, it's essential to have a very, very strong press. There are sometimes, that's the only way you're going to get information is by people insisting that you not use their name. And that's a bond and agreement you make. And unless you are freed of that, as was the case with the Time magazine reporter, you do take it to the hilt and say, okay, that's what it comes down to. This is what I got to do in terms of my integrity of my profession.
Laura, what of your thought, though, of Matthew Cooper having further conversations with his source and obviously ultimately talking about the ability to come clean, if you will?
Well, there is so much about this case that we do not know, and it is so murky. As I understand it, he had conversation, perhaps not directly with his source, but through his source's lawyer. And this was after a series of reassurances that were given to both him and Judith Miller by the administration. Basically, the sources involved here were all asked to sign a pledge saying releasing the reporters from the confidentiality agreement. But at least in the case of Judith Miller, she believed that release was not given willingly, so she has decided that it doesn't matter. In the case of Mr. Cooper, he apparently had some further reassurance. I agree with George that this is really an important principle that has to be protected, despite the fact that we don't know enough about this case. A promise is a promise is a promise, and if you can't protect your sources, if you can't protect the confidentiality issue, then we won't have a free exchange of ideas. I think there's a couple. He mentioned Novak. I think there's a couple other issues here related in particular to Novak that are important to remember that sort of get lost in this. One is that Novak outed a CIA operative. He had the option not to do that. Wherever the information came from, he chose to do that. I think that's something that we need to look at very carefully, the responsibility the press has in handling information. And the second thing is this whole issue of anonymous sources. Judith Miller and many other journalists in Washington, I think, overuse anonymous sources, and that puts them in a trick bag when they're in these kinds of situations. I think all journalists need to stay away from anonymous sources as much as possible, and that will help protect their rights as well as the rights of the sources.
I think it's important to note that, this was done in retaliation for her husband basically criticizing the invasion of Iraq. This is why Novak outed her in the first place. And it also points up the need, really, for a national shield law. Otherwise, we're going to have the same problem down the road in the future.
We should note, we keep throwing the name Bob Novak out, Robert Novak, and for people that don't know, he is a Washington pundit. Many of you would be familiar with his face, and for years, reporter and columnist, and many declare him, and he himself does, to be on the right, if you
and
take
he's a columnist
political
for
affiliations.
Chicago Sun-Times.
Yes.
So Chicago Sun-Times, my home paper.
And if you take political affiliations, he would be far or ultra-right. John, your thoughts on this?
Well, it's so hard to say at this point, especially because Novak hasn't really come clean. There's something clearly a little bit fishy that's going on, or else he would have come clean. But the fact that the conservative, I don't know if he's an ultra-right-winger, but the conservative columnist is somehow going scot-free, no complications, while we have these bizarre machinations with the other two, clearly means that there's something about this story that we need to learn more about, which presumably, if Novak comes clean, we'll know sooner rather than later. But obviously, there's some sort of skullduggery going on, and yes, it definitely traces back to a certain vindictiveness on the part of the administration who felt that company policy was not being upheld.
All right, John McWhorter, I'll suggest that he doesn't have perhaps a poster of McCarthy in his office, but he's pretty far right. Okay.
Standard right winger.
Let's continue to take a look at the court systems and what also happened on Wednesday, and that is a federal judge declared a mistrial in the notorious B.I.G. or Biggie Smalls wrongful death case that we've been covering and hearing so much about. Here's the interesting point. The judge expressed concern at a hearing on Tuesday that the Los Angeles Police Department, and more specifically a, quote, what has been deemed or what has been tagged as a rogue cop, had deliberately withheld evidence from the court that would have obviously shed more light on the death of the rapper and perhaps implicated Los Angeles policemen as a part of the situation here. This was uncovered by an anonymous tip that led to the discovery of a large number of LAPD documents that had not been turned over to attorneys and, in fact, were in a locked drawer in a detective's desk.
Now, that's
does this
a good
say
source.
Anything?
That's a good anonymous source. You
yeah,
need
that's a good anonymous source. What does this say? We've been hearing whispers about the LAPD and rogue cops' involvement in the death of not only Biggie Smalls, but possibly Tupac Shakur.
What
George
this
Curry,
says,
is this a smoking gun to some degree?
Well, it certainly is, especially when the judge said it was deliberately withheld. You would think that all the problems that the LAPD have had, that you wouldn't keep having the same kind of problem, but it exists, and it does underscore the problem with that police force.
There's certainly a problem with that police force, and it would be a low-down, dirty shame if it turned out that Biggie Smalls and or Tupac were gunned down by rogue white racists. But on the other hand, if you talk about, quote-unquote, what we really need to be talking about, it's that one of these rappers seems to get killed or shot about once a month, and that these are African-American, young, and talented people, and that this is a crisis. We have to face the fact that people from Radiohead don't get shot in the butt. Elton John has never been shot in the butt. There's something wrong with that particular pop culture. And usually it's not a white racist policeman. It's usually another rapper. There was a man here in New York, in Brooklyn, who got shot after a cookout, a father of four, who was an aspiring rapper, shot by some other rappers just because they didn't want him in the way. I'm more interested in that than in the rather visceral instances where it turns out that it might have been because of somebody white who isn't nice. There's a systemic problem here, as it's often put, and
I think this would be something exceptional.
Let me just clear up a couple of things here, George, and then I promise I'll let you go, but not every cop involved in the whispers here is white, A, and B, John, I don't know about once a month a rapper shot, but clearly it's a problem. All right, George, go ahead.
And we need to make the distinction. We're talking about people here who are supposed to be protecting the community, operating with a badge and a gun. And that's a different standard, and that's two separate issues, and we shouldn't confuse the two.
I agree there are two separate issues, but I would also argue that both of them do have some systemic roots. As has been said, the corruption has been endemic and it seems almost rampant in the L.A. Police Department, going back from way before the days of Rodney King. It seems like it's in the water there, and now no matter how many new administrations we get, now no matter how many efforts of reform we get, we come back to this issue again and again, and I think we need to put the focus on it. I think to John's point, though, about the impact that that violence in the rapper community has beyond, you know, the notorious bigs and the high-profile people is profound, and the young men, young African-American men look up to these people. They want to emulate these people. There are a lot more young men that want to be rappers now. And don't correct me on this one because I know you are, Ed. I don't know for a fact, but there are a lot of young black men that want to be rappers who used to want to be basketball players, and nobody wants to be a doctor anymore.
And Ed, if you look in 2003, it is roughly once a month. I checked. It's very, very common, and it's a problem.
Well, it depends on how you define rapper, but I concede to you that it is a huge problem in our community, one which I think we do a lot of finger pointing about. In terms of who has the ability to oversee these young men. And quite frankly, it is a community problem. We can't accept when it's appropriate the idea of the village raising our children, and then when we want to walk away from the idea that some of our children aren't being raised by our village, it's not quite as embraced. So I can see that it is clearly a problem that we all must face. All right, folks, thank you so much for an entertaining conversation. We didn't get to, and we'll save it for next week, a question we were going to raise based on a Parade Magazine online entertainment poll that showed if Oprah Winfrey ran for president, she would in fact trounce George Bush. So we'll talk about that next week. Laura, John, George, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.